Pope Francis has been in office now for 2 months, and he has frequently made headlines for remarks that contrast sharply from his predecessors and even centuries-old Catholic dogma. The latest was a statement last week that all human beings, including atheists, can be redeemed. NPR's Sylvia Poggioli joins us on the line from Rome to discuss the new pope. Good morning, Sylvia.
Good morning, David.
Okay, so tell me about what the pope actually had to say about atheists here.
Well, this was in a homily that he delivered in the chapel of the residence where he has decided to live. He recites Mass and delivers a homily there every morning, except Sunday, for Vatican employees and whoever else might be staying at the Domus Santa Marta. In a passage inspired by the Gospel of Mark, Pope Francis said, "The Lord has redeemed all of us with the blood of Christ, not just Catholics, everyone, even the atheists." The Pope added, "We must meet one another doing good." Now, headlines immediately proclaimed, "Even atheists can go to heaven." But the Vatican intervened. A spokesman said people who know the Catholic Church cannot be saved if they refuse to enter or remain in her. Yes, the Vatican spin tried to dampen the media hype, but the remarks are still an example of greater inclusiveness under this pope. Early in his papacy, he said atheists can be precious allies in the building of a peaceful coexistence between peoples and in the careful protection of creation. So this is the style of a parish priest who wants dialogue with his flock and beyond.
Yeah, not just an offhand remark. I mean, this was clearly a message that he wanted to send. And this does not sound a lot like Pope Benedict, who left this office several months ago.
No, absolutely. Benedict's speeches were heavy on theology and carefully prepared. Francis uses a conversational down-to-earth tone, and to the dismay of the Vatican press office, he often improvises. He talks about his personal history. He gives homey anecdotes about his mother and grandmother. He even said recently that he sometimes nods off to sleep while praying. You never heard anything personal from Benedict, who focused on the dangers of the contemporary world. Francis seems to have a more optimistic personality. He loves to mix with the faithful in the huge crowds in St. Peter's Square and shake hands and kiss babies.
This pope has also been talking a lot about economic injustice, about poverty. I mean, is there an anti-capitalist message here as well?
Well, he's certainly opposed to what's called laissez-faire capitalism. He has delivered a series of strong statements. Unbridled capitalism has taught us the logic of profit at all costs, of exploitation without regard to persons. He fiercely criticized the cult of money and said the origin of the global financial crisis was the lack of person-centered ethics in the world of finance and economics. He said if investments in the banks fall a bit, it's a tragedy, but if people die of hunger, they don't have enough to eat, well, that doesn't matter. This is tough language, and it's a signal that these concrete issues like poverty and globalization are going to be the focus of his papacy. He's already been dubbed the first global pope, and his focus is far beyond just Europe and the developed world.
Well, and Sylvia, what about the concrete issues inside the Vatican itself? I mean, this new pope came in at a time of scandal, at a time when the Catholic Church in many ways seemed in disarray. Is he addressing those things?
Well, one key move has been his appointment of a committee of eight cardinals, all but one from outside the Vatican, as his advisors. This could be seen as a more collective church management from now on. Another important issue is the murky dealings of the Vatican Bank, long suspected of being involved in money laundering and other illegal activities. Last week, the Vatican issued its first report saying it found six suspect transactions in 2012, acknowledging that was five more than the previous year. This is an effort at greater transparency, and it comes under Francis's watch.
All right, Sylvia, thanks so much.
Thank you, David.
We've been hearing about Pope Francis, who's been in office for 2 months, from NPR Sylvia Poggioli in Rome. This is NPR News.
Pick any weekend on the calendar, and you're likely to find a geek culture convention somewhere in the U.S. The grandfather of them all is in the San Diego area. It's the San Diego Comic-Con. Each fall, it draws more than 130,000 comic book, sci-fi, and horror fans. A relative newcomer to this convention scene is happening further up the California coast. From Los Angeles, Tess Vigeland has this story about the event known as Stan Lee's Kamikaze and its founder.
Regina Carpinelli grew up the only girl in a family with five boys. Suffice it to say, her childhood was not all rainbows and unicorns.
I automatically liked everything that the boys liked, so my life was playing Terminator and reading Spider-Man.
So it shouldn't be surprising that she now runs one of the most successful pop culture conventions in the country. Except that she's all of 31 years old, and her convention experience consisted entirely of being a fan. The first kamikaze convention debuted in November 2011, just 1 year after Carpinelli decided San Diego's Comic-Con had outgrown itself. She'd been going since she was 12, but in 2010, she couldn't get tickets. Not only that, but she felt Comic-Con had strayed too far from its horror sci-fi roots, and that the organizers no longer understood their audience.
I meet the owners. They're not fans. Yeah, they know what Superman is and Wonder Woman, but they can't name all the My Little Ponies and all their personality traits.
She certainly can. So in 2011, Carpinelli and a staff of five managed to get a hall at the LA Convention Center and spent months trying to get some big stars to take part.
Waterboarding tactics.
Among them, comic book icon Stan Lee and character actress Cassandra Peterson, better known as Elvira, Mistress of the Dark. Both signed on, and Peterson was thrilled with the access she had to fans.
Last year, I did a big Elvira museum. I brought my macabre mobile in and my original red couch where I hosted horror movies from. You know, fun stuff where I'm not just sitting at a table, just signing autographs and a lot of, you know, moving along real quick.
Peterson and Stan Lee became Carpinelli's business partners and investors after 35,000 fans showed up that first year. Star Wars Mark Hamill has attended, as did TV Batman Adam West, hosting a panel with the director, Kevin Smith.
What's left for you? What do you still want to do?
Oh, Lordy, Kevin, that's such a great question. I mean, just send the check.
One attraction of Kamikaze is the admission price. Carpinelli was determined to keep it low so that fans could spend their money instead on merchandise and autographs. A weekend pass is just $30. A four-day pass to Comic-Con is $150. The immediate and huge success of Kamikaze creates a challenge for Carpinelli as she tries to maintain intimacy and access for fans and not become another frenzied, bursting-at-the-seams Comic-Con. Nearly 50,000 people attended last year's convention. Analyst and self-described fanboy Jonathan London, the founder of Geekscape, is not worried.
She is a fan herself. So whenever Kamikaze grows, and as it grows, and you know it's growing like a weed, she's going to keep reassessing the convention from a fan's perspective.
Something Regina Carpinelli hopes to do with fans around the globe, as Kamikaze makes plans to set up shop in Brazil, London, and China.
I want to take over the world. I want to inspire kids to write, to draw, to create.
And even to know that it's okay to be 40 years old and dress like a stormtrooper. For NPR News, I'm Tess Vigeland in Los Angeles.
You're listening to All Things Considered. This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Alyssa Block.
And I'm Robert Siegel. Nadeem Aslam has written about worlds that overlap awkwardly. Pakistan, the country where he was born, and Britain, the country where he grew up and lives. His latest novel, The Blind Man's Garden, is set in Pakistan, in a town in the Punjab. Two young men, Mikal and Gio, foster brothers in love with the same woman, set out for Afghanistan in late 2001. Through their eyes, we see the consequences of 9/11 very differently than we're accustomed to.
The United States was attacked last month. A day of fire visited on its cities. And as a consequence, Western armies have invaded Afghanistan. The battle of the World Trade Center and the Pentagon is what some people here in Pakistan have named September's terrorist attacks. The logic is that there are no innocent people in a guilty nation. And similarly, these weeks later, it is the buildings, orchards, and hills of Afghanistan that are being torn apart by bombs and fire shells. The wounded and injured are being brought out to Peshawar, and Gio wishes to go to the border city and help tend to them.
The Blind Man's Garden is a powerful, vividly written novel, and Nadeem Aslam joined us from London to talk about writing and about the young people he's written about.
One of the things I wanted to do was to write about the young, because I think in this world we underestimate the grief and the confusion of the young, that here we have these new lives who are given the idea of love, the idea of compassion, if they're lucky, the idea of responsibility. And then we enter the world, and the world says to the young, corruption is possible, lies are possible, you can do the bad things. So the confusion which then results within the young person, that was what I'm increasingly becoming interested in. So these two young men who are very young, they are 20, and Pakistan's median age is 19. So they are almost children. And they don't understand the war that they go to, not fight in, but participate in, let's just say.
Yes, one of them is a medical student or a doctor. He's going, he thinks he'll be a medic there, yeah.
Exactly. The idea of compassion. And people always say, where is the hope in your novels? Because the books can appear to be very bleak. But I always say that the hope is that under any given circumstances, how the characters behave, that you will be destroyed, but you will be destroyed in the path of doing the right thing.
Yeah. We should just note that you're writing about young people now from the age of, is it 47?
Indeed.
That you are today? So that's your perspective. You're also writing across another gulf, apart from the generational one, which is you're writing about people, most of whom are guided by a faith, a religious faith, that is absolutely, perfectly literal. There are people who believe literally in consequences in the afterlife, literally in the commands of God. And it is sometimes startling and difficult, but we manage to empathize. Those of us who do not possess this literal faith, I think, still come to empathize with them.
I don't either.
You don't either, no.
I don't either. That's the thing. But there are people in my life who do. I mean, my mother is a believer. She prays five times a day. She fasts during the month of Ramadan. And she believes in an afterlife, all those things that make the modern mind uncomfortable. Mm-hmm. And yet she is also the person who taught me everything that I know. In that, in order for me to come to this studio to record this interview, I have had to make a journey. I have met strangers. I have greeted people, etc. So my daily conduct on a second-to-second, minute-to-minute, hour-to-hour basis was taught to me by that woman, who actually believes in the things which, if I were to explain to some people, that they would think, well, actually, this person can't be rational. So that is, I think, the interesting thing of having someone like that in your background.
Your father, I gather, did not share her faith at all.
Indeed, indeed. My father comes from quite a liberal bohemian family. But through my mother, I acquired the idea of consequence, the idea that if you do something bad, don't expect to get away with it. That idea entered my life through religion. And of course, that lesson can enter a child's life through 100 different ways. It can come through myths. It can come through secularism. But with me, as I said, given my background, it came through religion.
So a sense of purpose, ethics, idealism, all can be the residue of a religious upbringing without the devout belief.
Absolutely.
I gather in the writing of your latest novel, you spent several months in which you say you had no contact with any other human being. And in the past, when you've written novels, you've had no time for any friendships. How isolating is the process of writing a novel? How long did you actually go without dealing with anyone in writing The Blind Man's Garden?
Well, I have to go quite a few years back. I was born in Pakistan and I grew up there. I was 14 when I came to Britain. My father was a communist and he got into trouble with the Pakistani regime back in the early 80s. And at 14 when I came to Britain, I had no English because I don't come from an affluent background. I had gone to a non-fee-paying government school.
You were taught in Urdu until that point?
I was taught in Urdu and my level of English was quite basic. And the subjects I did well were sciences. But in my third year at university, by which time I'd been in Britain for 7 years, I realized that my English was good enough to do what I really wanted to do, which was to write a novel. So I dropped out and began writing my novel, which took 11 months to write. Then I said to myself that because I couldn't do my high school years in the subjects I was interested in, history, literature, politics, languages. Now, over the next 10 years, I'm going to sit down and do them, but I'm going to do them myself. And during this decade, I was also working on my second novel, Maps for Lost Lovers. And to answer your question, the earlier question, during that time, because I had no money, Whenever I had money, I would save it. And that meant that my social life began to disintegrate. So by the end of that 10 years, I was more or less without any friends. And during those 10 years, and they were formative years, I ended up living next to some very noisy people. And because I couldn't afford to move, I used to sleep during the day and write at night when it was quiet. So, and as I said, they were formative years. So that still lingers.
For writing this novel, you took how many months without contact with other folks?
Months can go, sometimes a year can go by, mm-hmm. and I don't see anyone. But whatever an artist goes through to make his art is really irrelevant. This book took 4.5 years to write. So have I at the end of those 4.5 years, no matter what I went through, that is not important. What is important is, have I come out with a good enough work of art?
Well, Nadim Aslam, thank you for the novel, The Blind Man's Garden, and thank you for talking with us about it.
Thank you very much for inviting me.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
The Gulf Coast is still rebuilding more than 3 years after the BP oil spill. States are lining up to spend $1 billion from BP on coastal restoration. The money is part of the company's legal responsibility to restore the Gulf of Mexico's natural resources after the worst oil disaster in U.S. history. But the nature of those projects, including boat ramps and a beachfront hotel, is raising questions about just what counts as coastal restoration. NPR's Debbie Elliott has that story.
It had all the trappings of an economic development announcement when Alabama Governor Robert Bentley stood on a sugar-white state park beach to announce plans for an $85 million lodge and conference center.
Gulf Shores is open for business. It sure is. And also Orange Beach now.
State lawmakers, local mayors, and business owners were all smiles to hear that the legislature had finally, after years of stalemate, given the go-ahead for a hotel on state park property near Gulf Shores, Alabama. The state can contract with private companies to build and run the facility. What pushed the hotel through this year, as noted by Lieutenant Governor Kay Ivey, is that BP is footing the bill.
Without costing the taxpayers a dime.
All five Gulf states are sharing in the $1 billion from BP. It's a down payment on what the oil giant will be forced to pay under a lengthy process called Natural Resources Damage Assessment, intended to restore the Gulf ecosystem to the condition it was in before the 2010 oil spill. Governor Bentley says improving the beachfront state park achieves that.
The lodge and the meeting facility are part of an overall effort to strengthen the Gulf Coast and our natural environment.
The first round of plans from Texas to Florida includes barrier island restoration, artificial reefs, science and education centers, boat ramps, and boardwalks. It's not unusual that states are lining up projects that don't directly restore the environment, according to Seattle attorney Valerie Lee. She's president of Environment International, a firm that specializes in natural resource damage assessment.
Some of the projects are like coral reefs. You know, you had problems with injury to coral reefs. But you also see things like visitor centers. How on earth could a building repair the environment? Well, it's not directly repairing the environment. What it is doing is compensating for the recreational lost uses, human uses that are associated with a quality Gulf.
But Lee says the Alabama Beach Hotel might be a stretch.
That, to me, is not providing a public use and a public benefit if, indeed, you're actually charging the public for a hotel room.
Alabama officials argue the public couldn't use the beach when it was soiled with oil, and now a new hotel will attract people back to the Gulf Coast. Orange Beach, Alabama Mayor Tony Kennan says it's a smart strategy to first seek human use reparations, which he calls the low-hanging fruit in the damage assessment process.
A lot of the environmental projects are going to take more time to evaluate, to look at, to make sure that we're not cutting ourselves short by jumping in too soon and not asking for enough to fix the problem. Whereas when it comes to loss of human use, which is where this money comes under, that's ready for us to grab right now.
It could take years of assessment and negotiation to determine the ultimate damage to the Gulf and what BP should pay to repair it, a figure likely to be in the billions. In the meantime, environmental groups want to see early investment in building a more resilient ecosystem. Projects like this oyster reef on the breezy western shore of Mobile Bay.
This is the site of the very first environmental restoration project done in the aftermath of the BP oil disaster.
Casey Calloway is director of Mobile Bay Keeper. She says 2 years ago, about 600 volunteers came to this waterfront park in Mobile to lay a quarter mile of oyster shell in the bay, just off the shore.
What you're hearing this new wave sound behind us is the wake from a ship.
Those wakes from the large ships that pass through Mobile Bay have eroded marshes and eaten away at the shore. Calloway says the new oyster reef absorbs the wave energy before it reaches land.
That enables the shoreline to build up behind it. That adds land. That is environmental restoration. It's property enhancement. It's better for insurance purposes, flooding, hurricanes, you name it.
Technically, Calloway says, the state may be able to call a hotel restoration. But she says it makes her uneasy about how future monies to compensate for the BP oil spill might be allocated.
When the very first thing that's supposed to be environmental is going to an economic project, that's not okay.
The early restoration plans have received the okay from BP, Gulf States, and the Obama administration. The next step is public comment and review. Debbie Elliott, NPR News, Orange Beach, Alabama.
Now we head to Detroit. We've reported a number of times on the city's serious financial difficulties. The city owes billions of dollars to creditors, and the governor of Michigan has appointed an emergency manager to try to settle the city's finances. Now that emergency manager Kevin Orr reportedly has his eye on the Detroit Institute of Arts, where the collection includes works by world-renowned figures like Matisse, Van Gogh, and Rembrandt. Jerome Vaughn is with us to tell us more. He's the news director at member station WDET in Detroit. Jerome Vaughn, thanks so much for joining us once again.
Glad to be with you.
First of all, could you just tell us about the role that the Detroit Institute plays in the life of the city? I would imagine that school kids all have memories of visits there.
Oh, for decades and decades, field trips, one of the first introductions to art will be at the DIA, where you can go and see something painted by Van Gogh or a sculpture by Rodin. It's something that's very important, and not just here in Detroit, but nationally, it's one of the top six collections in the entire country. So there's a lot of love of the DIA here in Detroit.
So what's been the reaction to the idea that the museum might, some of these works might be sold off. And I just want to mention here again that it's unusual among major city museums in that the city owns the building and the collection. Do I have that right? But that the daily operations are actually run by a nonprofit. So what's been the reaction there?
Well, the first reaction has really been shock and awe. I mean, people are stunned that this institution that they've come to love and the work that they've come to love could be potentially sold off to help pay down some of Detroit's debt. We've got a long-term debt of $15 billion. That's what's estimated right now. One of the reasons that emergency manager Kevin Orr has come in to right the ship in a number of ways. Even just, our fiscal year deficit is going to be about $380 million. But I don't think anyone ever thought that the art at the DIA might be a solution to some of that debt.
You know, you can see where families have faced the same dilemma when they are in financial difficulties. I mean, you know, people have heard about the idea of selling off the family jewels, right? Or selling off some land or selling off a treasured, some kind of treasured heirloom. You know, on the one hand, some people might say, well, that's common sense. You know, we've got to keep the family afloat. On the other hand, other people would say, well, you know, once it's gone and we'll never get it back. Do you have any sense of where people in the city kind of fall on this or how that's shaking out?
I think that same discussion has been happening over the past few days here in Detroit about the worth of art and the importance of art in the city's life and in individuals' life. You know, many folks have come out and said, you know, we've got to save this. We've got to save this. We've got to find a way to keep this from being sold. But at the same time, there's another group of residents who are going, you know, while I love art, I'd rather have a police officer on my block. I'd rather have the fire department come and put out a fire when it's needed to be done rather than have this art. And I think one of the surprising things that has really popped up in the past few years, and this is in many things in Detroit, has been a little bit of a racial component. Some African Americans have said, you know, this has to do with European art. This has to do not with taking care of the people in the city, but suburbanites wanting to hold on to something that has been established here for a long time. And there's starting to be a little bit of an undertone of that in this conversation.
Interesting. Now, is it a settled issue that emergency manager Kevin Orr will, in fact, put this art up for sale? I mean, which has been considered, I think, priceless, really. Or is it still something that is being debated? I mean, I guess what I'm asking is, does he even have a choice? Is it such a tangible asset that really his mandate requires that he offer it for sale? Or is there some debating room here, a negotiating room here?
I think there's a lot of negotiating room. One of Kevin Orr's spokespersons said he doesn't want to sell the art. What he really wants to do now is get a sense of what is there and to see if that is something, some information that can be given to creditors to say, hey, you know, this is what's going on. He says some creditors have asked if that's going to be in play. And so I think it's very preliminary in that sense right now. The other thing is there's going to be a lot of legal maneuvering. The DIA has hired a bankruptcy attorney to see how to protect itself. And because of this nonprofit, you know, controlling the collection and the city owning the collection, that's something that's got to be worked out, as well as there's a regional millage to pay for the DIA. That's going to lead to other lawsuits. So there's a lot of legal work that's going to be happening. I don't think anyone has a real grasp of where this is going to end up.
Very, very briefly, Jerome, any idea how much the collection is worth? Because these are the kinds of pieces that never go on sale.
That's right. The DIA says they've never really done an assessment because they've never thought about selling it. They say, you know, we're holding this in the public trust. One of the local papers here said, you know, one or two of the paintings alone could be worth more than $100 million each.
Wow.
One of them is Van Gogh's self-portrait. That could be $100 to $125 million alone.
Wow. Jerome Vaughn is the news director at member station WDET in Detroit. Jerome, thanks so much for joining us.
Anytime.
Probably heard about minimalist design. Now a growing chorus of middle-class parents say they're bringing that sensibility to family life, cutting back on all the music, lessons, sports practices, and summer camps, and trying to enjoy life more by doing less. We'll talk about that in just a few minutes on Tell Me More from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin.
And we'll end this hour on a different note. Our last word in business is acapella.
When we launched, you tweeted me we should catch up, but your next free meeting wasn't for 6 months. This time I'm not living without you.
We're hearing the group that bills itself as New York City's all-tech acapella group. In this video, they're rehearsing Lady Gaga's You and I, except in this version, the lyrics lament a different kind of breakup with an investor.
There's only three men that I'm a serving my whole life. It's my dad and my investor and Jesus Christ.
Okay, the group got this gig singing for the venture capital firm DFJ Gotham after debuting at the New York Tech Meetup.
They started performing together at the tech company Foursquare under the name Four's Choir. The Wall Street Journal reports that the group tabulates votes on which songs to perform using a spreadsheet.
Of course they do. And the group's current name also has some tech edge. It's pronounced NYC Sharp. But those of you familiar with sheet music will understand that Sharp is actually a hashtag. That's the Business News on Morning Edition. From NPR News, I'm David Greene.
And I'm Renee Montagne.